Welcome to MoFo Perspectives, a podcast by Morrison Forster, where we share the perspectives of our clients, colleagues, subject matter experts, and lawyers.
Hello, welcome to the MoFounders videocast, which is also available to be downloaded as a podcast. My name is Stephen James, a partner at Morrison Forster. MoFounders is a Morrison Forster group designed to bring together a community of entrepreneurs, investors, and advisors. As a founder or other business person, you may not think you have a personal brand, but in reality, you do. You may also think that you don't need a marketing strategy if your business is at an early stage, but you will almost certainly need that as well. To discuss this in more detail, I've been joined by Amy Wilson, a fractional CMO and marketing strategist, and Matt Swain, a personal brand guru. So, Amy, Matt, great to have you here. First of all, could you talk us through your experience of working with entrepreneurs, fast growth businesses, on managing their marketing strategies, their personal brand, and so on? Amy, I'll start with you.
So I've worked with startups and founders for about 15 years now. I often get introduced by investors or other people that work with them already, like CFOs or CTOs. I usually come in at a point of transition. So either a company's launching from scratch and beginning its fundraising journey, or it's raising a new level of investment that's kind of going to change the game for them. Or on the other hand, something might have gone a bit wrong and they might need some help, especially with brand and PR. So my experience is all about crafting a strategy that's right for the brand, because I work with such a big range of companies, from startups right through to, you know, Fortune 500 clients. It's all about finding the media mix and the right people, the right suppliers that work best for them.
Great. And Matt?
Nice. Yeah. So we focus on building personal brands for eight-figure founders. We believe that, like, the business space from a marketing standpoint is quite crowded, and that actually using a personal voice to convey your business's message and drive outcomes, whether that's investment, whether that's new clients, whether that's kind of big retainer deals or strategic partnerships, is a really effective way to kind of, you know, get that message out there and convey that.
And you sort of touched on it briefly there, but what do you consider, both of you consider, to be a personal brand? Because people talk a lot about it, but it's not often well articulated. How will you describe it, Matt?
Sure. So I believe that, like, everyone has a personal brand already. Like, we're all known for talking about certain ideas. We all have our own dress sense, unique tone of voice. It's about taking that brand that we already have, bringing it online, and then making it work for you. You know, so having those outcomes in mind and making sure that the brand that you have online, that presence, is driving outcomes for you.
Great. And Amy?
I think when it comes to business, personal brand is really important, because at the end of the day, people are the ones doing business and they're making the decisions about the other people they want to work with and spend their time with and interact with. So for me, it's taking maybe those pillars from your own personality that are relevant to your business. So your expertise around what it is you actually do, and then your belief system that supports how you operate within the business environment.
Okay, so taking that then, if I'm thinking about launching a personal brand, what are the really key things, the key elements that I should be thinking about if I'm looking to build a personal brand? Amy, I'll go with you first.
For me, I would say don't overthink it too much, because I think it wants to feel really authentic. So, you know, it might be that you're launching, if you're thinking about launching a brand that isn't something you're generally interested in, that would be something I wouldn't really recommend, because it's going to show through. So I think thinking about the things that are personally interesting to you, your values, how you want to operate in the world, and trying to pull those into the narrative when you're talking about your business and your business offering.
Would you agree with that, Matt?
Nice. Yeah, I like that. The extra thing that we try and do is we build brands through association. So it's like when you think of Apple, you think of simplicity, design, premium. And through all of their marketing and branding efforts, that's what they've been able to achieve. And so we think about it like, what associations do we want to tie to that person, and what associations are going to help drive towards their ideal outcome, and then using content to help build those associations and make them really strong. So, you know, if you want to be tied to the wellness space, then it's about really embedding that association that you as a founder are tied to the wellness space, as an example.
Yeah, because I think a lot, obviously, you talk about brands, for example, Apple, where they've got a very clear ethos. But if you're just starting out, it must be a bit intimidating to think, look, how, you know, I want to get to those levels of, you know, articulating your proposition. So how would you tell a startup if they say, okay, I want to be associated with the wellness space, how do they get deeply embedded in that sector, for example? How would you go about doing that?
Yeah, like, really, it's a case of content over a long period of time, where you can start to really embed that word within your kind of sphere and within your brand. And so, yeah, we're often kind of working backwards. So what outcomes do they want to drive? What associations would help drive towards those outcomes? And then how do we embed those associations in content? And so you can kind of work backwards from the kind of end goal as to kind of what associations you should be building. And then it's just a case of, you know, with content over time, really building those and strengthening them.
Yeah. And so, and in terms of things like getting that content ready, should you be doing that in a really systematic way so that you're then building a sense of discipline, so you've got a schedule of when you're going to release everything? Or does it need to be much more organic? I'd be interested for both of your views on this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, being too strict is not great, but having some level of discipline is also needed, because it is about consistency and compounding. And if you don't have certain systems and processes set up, then it just falls and slips away. You know, founders are busy people, and content can sometimes come down their priority list. So I think it's probably a good balance between the two.
A few years ago, I heard someone explain a content strategy as etiocial, and I really like thinking about it in that way and having a two-tiered approach. So you could think about planning out a 90-day content cycle, which is based on potentially wanting to boost your awareness around certain terms. So that sits really nicely with long-term SEO, which takes longer to build up. But then on the other side, the social side, it's maybe about tapping into more informational posts, things that are happening in your business in real time that you can post, informational updates, new clients, awards, things like that. And you can't really plan those because you need to post them as and when they're happening. And then the other side I've seen for social is planning a little bit around things that are happening in the world. So that's where you see brands talking about Water Day or Pizza Day or Pancake Day, because they've got this plan around all the things that are going to be talked about around that time on social media anyway, so they can tap into that when they plan their content. So for me, it's a mix of all those things and trying to balance it out. So it's kind of nicely done.
Yeah, I think like looking at those wider conversations that are happening in your industry and then inserting yourself and your business in those narratives is key. And often you don't know what the conversation is going to be in the following week. And so being open to the fact that there could be a, you know, big piece that you should comment on and insert yourself into that conversation is key. And those kind of things can't be kind of planned or regimented or put into a content strategy in quite the way that people might think.
Yeah, but it strikes me though that needs to be like really authentic though, because if you're just tying it into really arbitrary stuff, it can look like sort of a piece of desperate marketing. Like, we must make an association with this, like some I don't know, political or royal event has happened, and you're trying to take a benefit from that. And I think your customer base is going to see through that. So how do you manage that?
Yeah,
that well,
I was definitely going to carry out that with, yeah, you know, you don't need to jump on everything, and I think you can be really discerning about what you calendar days you choose to jump on. I remember seeing a really good one around, I think it was around one of the Queen's Jubilees or something, and it was a tights brand, and they'd done a rainbow queen. So of the Queen, so you know how the Queen wears like all different, or used to wear all different colours, but she would colour block. So they'd made a rainbow out of the Queen. And so things like that were really on, really made a lot of sense. But, you know, you don't want to be jumping on, you know, if you were an EV charging brand, you don't want to jump on Pizza Day because there's no...
Yeah, and I think going back to your point around the Jubilee is quite an interesting one, because I remember there being tons of marketing from all sorts of brands, and the link seemed to be pretty tenuous with it. So, you know, get a free something or other because it's the Jubilee kind of thing. Just that didn't strike me as being authentic.
Yeah.
So it sounds like what you're saying is you have to really, really think about any kind of association you're going to make with wider events.
Yeah, and I think it's about making it more industry specific. So like, we work with the largest US Amazon advertising agency. And so we're looking at like, what are Amazon doing? So like, for example, they recently charge extra now, like there's Prime sponsored ads, and you have to pay extra for your subscription. And so that's a very sensible thing for us to comment on. You know, if Amazon launched their kind of space program, et cetera, again, something very relevant to touch on. But I think it's that like wider industry conversation where you're actually building authority in your chosen market, as opposed to just putting something out there for the sake, because that can actually dilute that brand and dilute those associations that you want to build, because we want to if a brand is built on associations, then certain things will strengthen them. And then if you talk about too many things in too many different ways, you actually dilute those associations that you're actually trying to build.
So it sounds like you're saying there needs to be a consistency and clarity and clear sort of purpose of voice. Is that right? Or are there any other elements?
Yeah, and I think it's realizing that you don't want to comment on everything.
Yeah.
And it's working out what you do want to comment on.
Because that's what I say. If I go on, say, LinkedIn, for example, you see some users will like and share pretty much everything and anything in a view to get attention. So your view is that you need to be much more targeted, much more sort of incisive in terms of how you put yourself out there, all the things that you're like sharing, commenting on those sorts of things.
Exactly. Just because if you talk about everything, you dilute your brand and you stand for nothing. And so we want to build a really strong brand that has lots of strong values and strong opinions. And we want to embed those over and over again to build those associations. And in order to do that, you have to be careful what you do comment on. And so we wouldn't be looking into the kind of wider cultural kind of sphere. We're more industry focused in terms of the conversations that we're adding to.
Yeah.
I'd agree with that. And I'd say if you kind of have a choice, putting out lots of low quality content should absolutely be avoided. You know, bad content is almost worse than no content. And I think it's all about having a consistent quality, even if it's not going out every day or every week, but the quality will shine through rather than the volume.
Okay. And so if we then focus on, say, specific individuals or specific brands that you think have really strong personal brands, who inspire you and think, actually, that is an incredible personal brand, this is what people should be aiming for, perhaps be as being aspirational. Which are the ones that you admire? Amy, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it's a hard question to answer because I don't want to go off the rails and say something really niche that nobody knows about. So I'm settling on the Obamas, and I've really enjoyed the way they've established their personal brand since Obama stepped back from office. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about the brand pillars. And I think what's really interesting is when Michelle Obama's autobiography came out, there was so much going on about their relationship as a couple. There was authentic narrative about the troubles in their marriage, which was in the book. And then you had Barrack kind of gate crashing some of her speaking events, and it was done in a really nice, like, flirty way that got a lot of coverage. And then I think also looking at their production company, the film they recently produced on Netflix with Julia Roberts, which name I'm going to forget, but it's all about the end of the world and cyber hacking and everything. I thought it was really interesting the way that they chose to kind of delicately position themselves behind that issue, because it is political, but they've done it through their production company. So I think the way they're gently supporting their brand with all these different pillars is really fascinating to me, and I think it's really well executed.
So I think what I'm getting from that is a sense of vulnerability, sense of personality and warmth, and that sort of personal touch. Is that right?
Yeah, I think they're authentic, and they're choosing topics that are difficult to talk about, and they're walking the line on how they're talking about those really, really well.
Yeah. Matt?
Nice. I've got a few different ones. So
excellent.
I think Ant and Dec have a great personal brand. Like, they've stood the test of time. There's been a few hiccups in their journey, but they've become more popular throughout all of it. I think, like, Luke Littler is really interesting because there's a lot of attention on Luke and him as a sportsman, but there's also a lot of attention that he's brought into the actual darts community and the darts sporting world. So that's a personal brand having an impact in that entire kind
of extraordinary. It's completely changed the game, like the level of profile that the whole sport had at the beginning of the year was absolutely extraordinary.
Exactly. So I think he's a good example. Richard Branson realized the power of building his personal brand before it became a popular thing to do so. And again, he did it through traditional methods and hasn't, you know, just done it through posting TikToks, etc. And so I think that he's an interesting case. But there's also a lot of, like, niche personal brands that aren't well known, that we wouldn't know of, but are incredibly outcome focused. You know, so if you take, let's say, somebody who sells yachts, you know, super luxury yachts, like, we probably don't know who they are, but in their circles, they have an incredible personal brand. They're getting lots of outcomes. And I think, you know, you can see this across, like, architecture and lots, you know, in their niche, they're incredibly well trusted and the authority voice. But that's what they're focused on. So I think it's worth giving them a shout out as well.
Well, it's very good of you, especially the super yacht owner. So if we were to take all those very disparate examples, what are the common threads that you think are uniting them, if there are any?
I think it's I think there's an element of buy-in to them and their story. I think in order to become trusted, you have to really buy into the person. And kind of touching on what we were talking about earlier, it's like business is done through people. And so they've been able to bring their personality to the forefront, their story to the forefront. And that's what's driving that interest. It's less about their business or trying to make money and more about, you know, kind of becoming a personable kind of figure that people buy into, that people build a connection and build trust with.
Okay. And so if I'm an entrepreneur, which I'm not, but which channels should I be focusing on? Social media channels? Is it LinkedIn? Is it all different channels? Does it depend on the nature of the business sector you're in? Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a really difficult, nuanced question, because I think, you know, ultimately, if we were to associate any social media channel with business, we would think about LinkedIn. But what's really important to consider about LinkedIn is how different people use it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to get lots of salespeople on LinkedIn, lots of business owners who are using it. But then if you think about a big corporate structure, senior decision makers within those big corporate structures don't tend to use LinkedIn, or the only time they really use it might be when they want to change jobs every 10 years. And their networking is happening much more internally with it, that, you know, the powers for them and the dynamics that matter to them are happening within their own organization. So you have to be a little bit more imaginative. And I think this is where PR can come in, because the types of people who aren't using LinkedIn as much, if you can see their expertise in the press, in Forbes or in, you know, Business Insider or places like that, those are the content that those people who aren't on LinkedIn are consuming. But the other one I think is quite nice is Instagram. You know, for me, I'm a busy person and I use LinkedIn for work. But when I've got a moment, I'm queuing for coffee or something, I'm on Instagram having a quick scroll. And that's when, you know, Masterclass and all the MBA programs start hitting me with ads. And that's when I've got time to kill. You know, if I'm on LinkedIn, I'm probably using it for a specific purpose, to reach out to someone, or, you know, I'm not using it to scroll forever and look at the content. So I think that's when how you have to think about it. It's not just as simple as which channel it is, but it's how those different stakeholders consume different channels. Again, if you're looking at Facebook's interesting, because if you're in certain sectors like a trade perhaps, or you own a hairdressing business, we know from research that those are the networks preferred by some of those trades and business owners, because they feel a bit ostracized perhaps by LinkedIn. Teachers, people working in the arts, they're not known for being on LinkedIn. So it really, really, you need to kind of look at who you're trying to contact and connect with and why, and think about which channels they'll be using, and not only how they'll be using them, but how they're consuming them at different points of the day.
Matt?
Nice. So it depends on the outcomes that you're looking to achieve. I think that, like, LinkedIn is very much a B2B perspective. And so if you have a, you know, direct to consumer brand, then you probably want to be, you know, getting the clicks and selling on other platforms. But there's still an interesting B2B angle that can be done on LinkedIn. So, you know, investments, strategic partnerships. But I think it's important that it's seen as, you know, a B2B landscape. And so if you're looking to drive, you know, drive consumers to your product, then LinkedIn is not the place to be to do that. But there are still other ways that can be, you know, used on there.
Yeah, no, that all makes sense. And obviously, personal brand feeds into the general proposition about having a marketing strategy. So if I'm a startup, you've got to do some marketing, but you're restricted on spend, you're restricting on what you can do. You may not necessarily have any specialist skills in marketing. So how on earth do you begin to start to formulate a marketing strategy, which so goes beyond just, say, the social media aspects that we've already talked about? Amy, if I start with you.
I think you're right. You know, it can be a real challenge for startups when they don't have a lot of budget or they're trying to fundraise. And I think the most simple answer is using your network is the best way to start to formulate a marketing strategy. And, you know, kind of being a bit humble about acknowledging what you don't know, because there are plenty of people in the ecosystem that will mentor and coach, especially if you're in an accelerator. You know, taking advice from the people who have done it before, taking advice from people like me who do coach startups in those environments, because that doesn't necessarily cost money, but it will help you work out how to prioritize what resources you do have in the first instance. And then when you are lucky to have a bit more money, maybe you've done a fundraise or you're revenue positive, you know, again, taking advice about the decisions you make, because one of the most common things I see is people making short-term decisions, hiring underexperienced teams, and they actually end up causing more problems in the longer term. So if you can afford to bring in a fractional, for example, just to get a couple of days advice, or
And just on that, tell us more about what
being
a fractional does.
Yeah. So the idea of a fractional is that we work in a, I suppose, part-time basis. But the reason for that is so that the startup doesn't have to commit to the high cost of having a C-suite on a salary. And by working with some fractionals like me, you work from down to sort of 2 days a month. So you can see how much that proportionally would bring down the cost. And the idea is that startups don't necessarily need to have that person full time. There might not actually be enough. You know, I've worked with startups plenty of times where there's not enough workload to really justify having someone at that senior level in the business full time. But when there are big decisions that need to be made or something goes wrong, you have the benefit of being able to tap into that strategic advice. And, you know, that can be done flexibly. It can be ramped up for specific projects, or it can be done on a kind of wait and see until fundraising comes in. So, you know, taking advice, getting the best advice about when you're making really important decisions saves you so much pain in the long run. And there's other fractionals as well, like finance, tech, you know, we exist because we take pleasure from working with companies in that earlier stage, and we can have a lot more influence, and our advice can, you know, really, really help the founders that we work with.
And what would you do? Would you sit down with them and formulate a formal, say, almost written strategy about how you're going to attack your marketing for the next 6, 9, 12 months? How, or is it just saying, well, let's just hit a few things that you need to do in the short term and grow from there? How does it work? Or is there not a one size fits all approach?
It really comes back to budget. Yeah. You know, if you've kind of got an A-level media studies budget and a sort of Scorsese ambition, it's going to be a bit difficult. And that's quite often the what you have to do at the beginning of a project. You have to set those expectations about really what the budget that's available can achieve. And you know, there might be those founders out there who want, you know, a 100-page detailed plan, but they don't really even have the budget to justify going into that much depth. And I think you raise an interesting point about how long you plan for as well, because especially with companies that are just starting out, things can change very, very quickly. So you can, and with the investor context as well, you have to be really careful. You don't want to commit to doing something over a 12-month period. If something suddenly changes, it might enable you to do more, it might enable you to do less. So for me, it's an art form of expectation management and keeping in mind all the factors that could change. And for me, really planning outside of 6 to 9 months with an early stage company, especially if there's a fundraising gate or something in that time period, just becomes a little bit of a silly exercise, because you're probably going to have to recalibrate as you go. But certainly when you're fundraising, having a written go-to-market strategy is really, really important. I've been an incoming CMO on companies that are fundraising, and the investors, you know, half of the investment money might be going onto marketing. So the investors really want to understand that there's a concrete plan, or certainly a pragmatic plan that's going to be tracked against various objectives. And they're going to want to really understand the different medias that you're going to employ. And quite often you might be dealing with investors who don't have a really deep understanding of the current technologies and the digital marketing landscape. So that can be a point of, you know, that can make them worry about potentially investing. So making sure that you address that when you're planning the go-to-market strategy is really important.
So you would expect investors to want to see a very cohesive, coherent marketing strategy if they're looking to invest, even at a pretty early stage. Is that right? Or
yeah, but at the same time, you know, a lot of the medias that you can employ today are very, very flexible. You know, it's not like you go, I'm going to spend, you know, £500,000 on search and the money's been booked away. It's very flexible. You can run campaigns for days or weeks and get quite large volumes of data. And I think one of the things that often puts investors' minds at ease is if you say to them, well, you know, we're not going to just sign off $500,000 check on something we don't know it works. We're going to test it here, and if this delivers this result, we're going to increase it. And I think that you know, it's a tricky one, because you want to give a long-term plan, but at the same time, if you launch something and it's not working and you can turn it off, what, you know, why wouldn't you? Or if you launch something and it's working really well, why wouldn't you ramp it up? So it's about having, for me, it's about having a clear line of communication with the stakeholders, whether it's the founding team, the board, or the investors, or all of those stakeholders, so that they are confident in the processes around the decision making.
Mm-hmm. Matt, does that make sense to you? When you're working with startups, founders, they're looking at developing a marketing strategy, are they the sorts of considerations that you've been involved with? Have you seen investors or spoken to investors who said, look, I really need to see a very clear, cohesive plan around this? How would you
typically get involved in putting together those kind of strategies?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just touch on a more, if we go back to this kind of founder startup that wants to kind of, you know, do some marketing but are struggling with budget. One of the things that I would recommend from like a content angle is studying what's going well. Studying what's going well on those platforms. Like the amount of bad content that I see is just staggering. Like I almost think 99% of all content on social media is quite like bad content.
And what do you define bad content as being? How would you categorize that? What do you, when you've got on social media, you look at it and your eyes roll, what sort of thing are we talk?
It's just like not performing, like just not listening to best practices, you know, not very engaging, you know, way too salesy, etc. And so I think that there's a real thing that founders can do is actually just studying what good content looks like and then trying to mimic that, as opposed to, you know, just writing random nonsense basically. You know, obviously you can bring in agencies and specialists that do that for you, but if they're, you know, struggling on budget, then I think like people should spend more time looking at what's going on in the marketplace and what good content looks like and try to study that more.
And can you post too often? So can it be a situation where you actually see there's just too much, people get a bit fed up by seeing another post from this person, so they're focusing on quantity over quality. Is that a risk? Is that a danger? Or do you think you should be posting as much as you want, but you've got to make sure the content is really interesting and engaging?
Yeah, I mean, the quality has to be there. It depends on platforms. So like someone like Alex Hormozi is posting about 10 TikToks a day. Right. And the way that the algorithm works is that it will just test out that content on a very small percentage of his audience. And if it is being engaged with, you know, that meets the algorithm, then it gets pushed to a wider audience. Somewhere like LinkedIn, it's works a little bit differently. And so kind of one post a day is the kind of maximum optimal. So yeah, it kind of depends on platform for something like that. But in general, I think that, you know, having a decent amount of consistency to get the compounding effect, to build that community, to have more kind of shots on goal to increase your reach, and, you know, the outcomes that you can generate is a good way to go.
So it sounds like you really need to understand the platforms, even understanding some of the algorithms behind them and how they operate. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think that can be done through studying them, and studying what's going well, what good content looks like. And that's what a lot of marketing and social media people basically have the expertise in. They're just looking at what's going on in the market. They're looking at what's doing well. They're trying to understand why that's done well. And then they're going to replicate that for you. And so you can kind of take that in-house as a kind of small startup and do that yourself.
Yeah. And this sort of personal journey bit, I sort of slightly cringe at in some ways, could probably do due to my profession. But, you know, I think it seems that a lot of personal posts really do resonate. So if you're talking about yourself, you're showing a degree of vulnerability or showing something about your life beyond your immediate job, your profession, that seems to resonate a lot more. Is that right? Is that just because of how human beings tend to work and they want to see a bit of, you know, of actual humanity in the post, as opposed to, put it for want of a better way of putting it?
Yeah, it's because it is going to apply to more people. So if you share, you know, a lesson about failure, a lot of people can relate and resonate with that. Whereas if you talk about you know, a specific process in how shoes are made, if you're in the kind of shoe industry, then there is a much smaller audience for that. That's still important to build your authority, but I've actually come to the conclusion that a lot of personal brand building is based on trust. And so I think that trust comes from stories, it comes from the journey element, and that's what really allows that buy-in. And so as much as authority is important, building trust is also vital, because, you know, as we kind of touched on a few times already, that like people will buy from the people that they trust, the people that they connect with on that deeper level. But that's why the personal posts tend to do better, that they resonate with a wider audience, basically.
Do you agree with that, Amy?
Yeah, it's reminding me of a post I wrote, I think, during COVID about ghosting, professional ghosting. And I still get comments on it to this day. And I think ghosting is a really interesting topic in relation to personal brand, because on the one hand, you could look at it like someone's getting ghosted because they're not very...
And just for those who don't understand
ghosting,
the term.
Yeah. It's when... it's been more traditionally used in dating, I have to say, but it's when you don't hear back from someone at all. And it's been acknowledged more in professional circles, I'd say, in the last 2-3 years. And I think, you know, anyone would understand, probably sending a cold outreach email and not hearing responses. But in the professional circles that I move in, I've been hearing a lot about people going through second, third round interviews and getting ghosted, or spending a whole day with someone pitching, you know, and there's just kind of this idea of it's rude and it's disrespectful. And I wrote a post about it, I think during COVID, and like I say, still get comments on it. So, and I think the idea is, you know, on the one hand, you could say, oh, someone's getting ghosted because they're not good at what they're doing. But what we're actually seeing is so many people talking about it at such levels of disrespect being used in, especially in job interviews and recruitment processes, that it's becoming quite, you know, anyone who's a freelancer or running a business or interviewing has probably been ghosted in quite an unacceptable professional way. So that one was quite interesting because it's a showing of vulnerability, and it did resonate with a lot of people, because in my post I was calling out, you know, as bad behavior basically. So I think that's a really nice example of talking about something that's maybe a bit difficult to talk about and could potentially reflect badly on someone, but actually the feedback I got was very positive because it was making other people feel better about the experiences they were going through at the same time.
And to Matt's point, it comes back to that shared human experience. Mm. A lot of people have probably had that sort of experience, and it's, you know, quite a difficult thing to deal with, and so you're going to get more sort of connection from people who may have nothing to do with your immediate circle online.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so if I were to build a brand new brand from scratch, what would be your sort of top three tips for developing a marketing strategy? I'll start with you, Amy.
So for me, one of the nicest pieces of work I get to do when I'm advising brands is something called a landscape analysis. And what we do there is we look at the competitors in the sector. And the reason we do that is because we don't want to pile on the same conversations that were already happening. What we're looking for is a way to differentiate the brand within the sector. So potentially topics they're not talking about, brand pillars that are slightly different. And so I would say that is a really good piece of work to do when you're starting out, because it's going to influence things potentially like your name, the colorways that you choose, the medias you choose to launch with, maybe even the regions that you launch your brand. And I think it's relevant for this conversation because you can do it for your own personal brand as well. You can see what the other thought leaders in the industry are saying and how you could potentially add a different angle to what they're already saying or bring up a new topic. So that for me is a really nice piece of work. And you know, you can get freelancers to do that for you, for your business or for your personal brand. Very kind of accessible, one-off piece of work, not too expensive. It, you know, obviously, if you go to a massive branding agency that's a household name, it's going to cost you probably six figures, but there are people that can do that, a nice piece of work for you. I would say network's really important, because when you're bootstrapping at the beginning, the people you know are the ones that are going to be able to open certain doors for you, potentially get you into, you know, if you've got a product, get you into the right stores, get you on the right shelves, get partnerships going. So those are all the things that I would be exploring first. And actually, when investors are looking at startups, they really look at the people involved and how they can be leveraged for a low cost. And then I think the PR, again, it can move the dial very, very quickly if you get the right piece of coverage. So for me, those are the things that I would see as the low-hanging fruit when you're launching a brand.
Great.
Nice. I'd go, number one is having something very unique about your offering. And so it's this really shareable element that you would, you know, if you were in the back of a taxi, you'd turn around and say, like, have you seen? And then you want to have something super shareable after that, basically. And then number two, I would have it very founder-led. So I'd be using the founder team. I'd be using employees to generate kind of traction. And thirdly, I would do a lot of like experiential marketing. So really in-person based experiences, if you have a D2C brand, or maybe more speaking and leveraging your personal brand into speaking opportunities if you're more B2B based. So those would be my three tips.
And just to chuck in my two penneth, I would also say make sure that if you're looking to launch a brand that you're able to use it. It's free to use, conduct searches. You can do some basic, Amy's laughing, but that's because, that's just this is my little joy. There are certain searches you can do online to check that brands are free to use. If in doubt, please speak to a specialist. And just seek to engage at the early stage. It's exactly the same with the marketing strategy. It's just to make sure you're thinking about these things up front.
Your point is so valid. The amount of times I've had to call you and take advice from the names that I've heard come across my desk, and people really think it's not going to be a problem, and it
And then that's the thing, because coming back to the personal element of this, the personal brand, people obviously have an emotional attachment to certain brand names, certain iconography. So that's why it's just important to check these things earlier on, because it can be an extremely painful process if you run into roadblocks. Obviously, I'm talking less about your own individual name. I'm talking more about brands that you're creating. But it can be, you know, pretty traumatic experience going through a rebranding exercise.
It's really expensive. It creates a nightmare. If you have to change the name, you're going to have to buy a whole new domain. You're going to usually lose some SEO benefits. I think the other thing that's really relevant to what you've just said is the use of AI tools, like logo generating tools that rely on AI, basically take imagery that's already out there in your sector. And so you're probably going to run into issues with differentiation around your imagery that you're using. And then the other thing I've come across a few times working in regulated sectors, there are certain countries where if you're using, in finance, for example, if you're using any word like money or lending, it's okay in the UK, and you can correct me on this, but there's certain markets where you wouldn't want to launch a brand that was like called Good Money or something, because they've got regulatory requirements in those countries that you can't make it look like you're officially involved with certain words and sectors. So definitely speaking to someone about that before you go and commission the branding agency.
Part of the piece, and what I think a message from this is just making sure that you're engaging the right stakeholders at the right time. You're thinking about these things all together. So if you're putting in a marketing strategy, you should be thinking about the personal brand. You should think about obviously working with a fractional CMO or some other outside investor. You should be getting legal advice to make sure that what you're doing is clear and that you can protect your rights, and doing that at a super early stage, making sure there aren't any regulatory hurdles. So it's all about as much as you can, and I think in a really sensible and proportionate way, making sure that you've got everything that you need, and then you can feel confident taking it forward, seeking investment, and being able to really build a brand. Does that make sense, Matt?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, well, I wanted to thank you both very much for your time today. I've got tremendous insights. I know that I'm going to be on LinkedIn and various other platforms trying to develop my own personal brand, and there's certainly a lot I can learn from that. And really grateful for you joining this Mo Founders video cast.
Amazing. Thank you for having us.
Please make sure to subscribe to the MoFo Perspectives podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you have any questions about what you heard today or would like more information on this topic, please visit mofo.com/podcasts. Again, that's mofo.com/podcasts.